Hello, it's Friday, the 19th of February, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming your way, the war in Syria has become a very dangerous chess match between the growing list of participants. We'll talk with VOA reporter Jamie Detmer. He's on the scene. The World Health Organization suggests controlling the Zika virus by setting up a mating game between mosquitoes. You'll hear from the CEO of a company that's carrying out the process.
In every trial we've done, we've reduced the Aedes aegypti mosquito population by over 90%.
And there is some new therapy that's showing remarkable success in fighting one type of cancer. It's all ahead. Today on International Edition, we talk with VOA reporter Jamie Detmer, who finds himself near the border between Turkey and Syria. Jamie, there was an attack on Ankara, Turkey's capital, this past week. And after that happened, Turkey stepped up pressure on the United States and other allies to cut off support for a militia group called YPG. Turkey apparently views YPG as a terrorist group because of its affiliation with the PKK, all in the history of the tension between Turkey and the Kurdish people in the area. However, the YPG has been most effective, according to the United States in the fight against the Islamic State group in Syria. And this apparently has led to what some are calling a very confusing mess when it comes to policy on the Syrian war. Can you, Jamie, possibly make some order out of this mess?
Untangling all of this is very complicated. There's so many moving parts. But today we have the Turks saying that accusing the U.S. of following a contradictory policy in Syria and in terms of their relations with Turkey, which some U.S. analysts, Charles Lister, for example, at the Middle East Institute, would agree with. Basically what's happened is, in order to fight the Islamic State, the U.S. has been looking for an effective ground partner, and it found it in northeast Syria with the YPG, which is part of an offshoot, if you want, of Turkey's outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is considered a terrorist organization, and by extension, so is the YPG. So the U.S. has been partnering with them east of the Euphrates River to fight the Islamic State. Turkey has always been uncomfortable with this, has been with months, keeps on having rifts with Washington over it, but the U.S. is rather wedded to their only ground partner at the moment. What's really made this far more complicated in the last 2 weeks really, is that the YPG has now also started attacking U.S. Western-supported Syrian rebel militias west of the Euphrates. This has not only caused ructions with the Syrian rebels, it's also raised issues about whether the U.S. was aware that this was going to happen beforehand, and it clearly is worsening relations with Ankara.
Well, let's factor in Russia to this conversation now. Where does Russia fit into all of this mess?
Well, Russia is a long-term patron of Assad and has really saved him. In the summer, Assad's regime really looked like it was defeated. It had suffered some stunning reversals. Then we get the Russian intervention, along with Iran, to prop up Assad. As well as that, Russia has been courting the PYD, the Syrian Kurds, who've had quite a long relationship with the Kremlin. And there is a belief, an accusation again by the Syrian rebels, that they have been receiving supplies from the Russians. There were a mysterious number of helicopters, Russian and Syrian government helicopters, going into this Kurdish enclave Afrin in December.
Does this mean that the U.S. and Russia are on the same side here in some aspect of the Syrian war?
Well, if you talk to Syrian rebels, they will say yes. They are convinced, and as you know, this region is no stranger to conspiracy theories, that there has been some kind of deal made between Moscow and Washington to allow this to happen. The U.S. government officials completely deny this, and they deny that they gave any kind of green light to the YPG to do this action in northern Syria, grabbing some towns back from rebels that Washington for several years has been supporting. It really is, because of the complexity of this war and so many moving parts, it's really very hard sometimes to stay on one side. You are slipping backwards and forwards. And what Washington has tried to do is to do a division, really, to say our priority is fighting the Islamic State. That's why we're aligned with the YPG and really searching for a political solution for the Syrian civil war generally.
How has Islamic State reacted to all of this?
Well, actually, they've been rather quiet. They've been doing some attacks in parts of northern Syria on the Syrian rebels, trying to exploit their problems with the Assad regime in terms of this huge offensive across northern Syria that Damascus, with Russian support, has unleashed. They've had some recent victories over, battlefield victories over, on the eastern side of Syria. But really, in a way, they've been rather sitting back watching the fireworks.
Well, as the phrase goes, this seems to be getting curiouser and curiouser as it goes along. And there, of course, are all kinds of stories surrounding this, dealing with refugees being caught between Syria and Turkey, which, unfortunately, we just don't have time to get into now. But all this gets worse, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've got piles of Syrians now on the border. It could be over 100,000 wanting to cross into Turkey to escape this offensive. We've got another ramification, which is there are a lot of NGO workers, Syrian NGO workers, who've been working on European and US-funded projects in Syria, and there's a lot of alarm about their future. People feel that they will be targeted by the regime, the Syrian regime, as they take back towns and villages. There are a lot of consequences from all of this and lots of ripple effects.
Jamie, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Well, there's another major story we're covering, and that has U.S. warplanes attacking an Islamic State training camp in western Libya Friday near the border with Tunisia, hit their main target, killed dozens of terrorist recruits, says the information we are receiving. Defense officials here in Washington said the airstrike likely killed a senior figure in the Islamic State group, Nouradine Chouchani, who was linked to two major terrorist incidents in Tunisia last year, attacks on the museum in Tunis and then that beach resort outside the capital, which together killed at least 60 people. We're keeping our eye on that. This is International Edition, and it's time once again to welcome in Andrew Palcheski, who is our social media guru. Am I the only one who calls you that?
I think they've adopted it in the other shows as well.
Okay, so that's good.
It's a trend. I like that. That's the kind of thing I can get behind that's trending.
Well, that's good. And I said it in less than whatever characters. But we are talking about also the death of a very popular author today, and I think it is trending, right?
Absolutely. Trending in the U.S. and around the world. Harper Lee, the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, is dead at the age of 89. So a lot of people are going onto social media and reacting. That's why it's the top trending topic in the U.S. and around the world. A lot of sadness being expressed for her death, and a lot of people saying, oh, this was one of my favorite books growing up. People saying they want to reread the book now, To Kill a Mockingbird, Pulitzer Prize-winning book, and an American classic, really.
Which we're all forced to read in school, by the
way,
but it turns out to be a good book.
And that's what other people are saying on social media, saying, oh, I had to slog through this book, but it actually, you know, I appreciate it now more than I did when I was in middle school or high school when I had to read it. And a lot of people sharing quotes from Harper Lee and from the book. My favorite that I've seen is one from To Kill a Mockingbird. It says, I think that there's just one kind of folks. So it was that very plain kind of style of writing that she had that a lot of people really appreciated.
What else going on?
Well, we also have actor Shia LaBeouf, performance artist, if you will. His latest performance art piece is he's going into an elevator at Oxford University and staying there for 24 hours, interacting with the students there as they come in and out of that elevator.
Gee, how exciting.
And he's live streaming it, so people are watching it online and commenting, and the general consensus is, why am I watching this again?
Is the elevator going to be going up and down? Or?
Up and down, all throughout Oxford and the building that he's in, and will be beamed around the world for everyone to watch and comment on.
I won't ask about personal hygiene or anything. I won't get into that.
Yeah, probably for the best.
That's about it, eh?
Yes.
Andrew Palcheski, once again with a stellar performance here on International Edition. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The United States District Court for the Central District of California recently ordered technology giant Apple to provide reasonable technical assistance to law enforcement agents in obtaining access to the data that's been locked in an iPhone used by one of the shooters in the December 2015 San Bernardino mass murder attack. In an open letter to customers, Apple CEO Tim Cook called the federal court order an unprecedented step which threatens the security of Apple customers. Cook says that Apple opposes the order and that it has implications far beyond the legal case at hand. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest says that the U.S. Department of Justice is not asking Apple to redesign its product or to create a new backdoor to one of their products. A number of advocacy organizations say that they support Apple's position in this case, while numerous U.S. politicians, including some presidential candidates, have criticized Apple's rejection of the court order. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. The World Health Organization said Tuesday that countries dealing with Zika outbreaks should consider using controversial methods to fight its spread, such as using genetically modified mosquitoes and biological agents that stop mosquito larvae from hatching. The WHO said its advisory board recommended trials using sterile irradiated male mosquitoes, a technique used to fight dengue in the Cayman Islands and elsewhere. It says other UN agencies have deployed sterilized mosquitoes to control other agricultural pests. The effort to develop these sterile male mosquitoes is being spearheaded by a British company. It's called Oxitec, and Oxitec's CEO is Hayden Perry, and he's been kind enough to join us now on International Edition. Mr. Perry, thanks for being with us. Why do you think the use of these mosquitoes can work to control the Zika virus?
Because, very simply, Zika virus is spread by this mosquito called Aedes aegypti, which has spread out of North Africa around the world. And it's really impossible to control this using chemicals. People have tried for many years, and the problem has been getting worse over the last 50 years. So the same mosquito spreads dengue fever and chikungunya and now Zika virus. So current methods really are not working. Now, the beauty of using these sterile mosquitoes that we've developed is that you're using a male mosquito to go out and find a female. And a male mosquito is always going to be a lot better at finding females than a human with a knapsack sprayer or a lot of chemicals.
So how effective is using the sterile mosquito? You have trials, obviously, and I think there have been some applications in Brazil. So how effective has this been?
Remarkably so, actually. I mean, we've been pioneering this for the last few years. So we've actually got field trial data, you know, using this outdoors in urban environments since 2009. In every trial we've done, and by trial, what I actually mean is we're releasing our mosquitoes in an urban environment. In every trial we've done, we've reduced the Aedes aegypti mosquito population by over 90% in about 6 months.
That is quite amazing, but as you know, there is opposition. Environmentalists have cautioned against the use of GMO mosquitoes, saying the long-term effects of killing off an entire insect population is unknown. About 150,000 people recently signed a petition against the use of the GMO mosquito. What do you say to these people?
Well, I think it's very important to understand exactly what we do. Now, people have a conception of genetic modification, and it largely comes from the use of genetically modified crops. And the normal perception is that if you're going to use something that's genetically modified, I'll put that in inverted commas, that you're putting a new gene or you're putting something into the environment that stays there and will spread and replicate. And that indeed is what most people think when you talk to them about this. But actually, with our system, it's the complete opposite. Every single one of our mosquitoes that we release will die in a few days. If they mate a female, then the offspring will die in a few days. Nothing stays in the environment. Nothing spreads. So actually, what you can do is you can control a mosquito population in a town without actually having any long-term effects in terms of the ecosystem. Because you're not spreading a gene, you're not, and nothing is staying in the environment. That's absolutely key. The other thing I would mention here is that we actually use a color marker, which is quite unique, actually, which means that we can actually see, in effect, where our insects go. We can see where they're having an effect. We can predict how many we need to release. It's a system of constant monitoring and metrics and understanding the effect we're actually having. And I would contrast that to what people do at the moment, which is using insecticides, where you fog or spray, where not only do you affect all insect life, including beneficials, but you actually have no real idea what the effect you're having. You're just putting chemicals into the environment and hope that's having an effect. With our approach, it's very precise, very well monitored. So it's really a perception issue, which I think we're up against. And where we have done trials and where we have done surveys of public opinion, for example, in Brazil, we've had astonishing support, actually, because people see what we're trying to do. We're trying to actually control disease that can kill. And there's a lot of support for that.
Hayden Perry is the CEO of the UK-based Oxitec company. And Mr. Perry, thanks so much for being with us. We greatly appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
You're in tune with International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. U.S. researchers are hailing the effectiveness of a new cancer therapy that produced remission in an overwhelming majority of patients in whom it was tested. As VOA's Jessica Berman explains, the therapy harnesses the power of the immune system to fight some of the most deadly blood cancers.
The prognosis for people with blood and lymph cancers is usually dismal, despite aggressive rounds of chemotherapy. The cancer often rebounds and patients die soon afterwards. But an experimental therapy that involves engineering the patient's immune system T cells has shown remarkable success in a number of small clinical trials. The work is headed by Stanley Riddell, a researcher at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in the U.S. state of Washington. In one study involving 35 patients with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or ALL, 94% experienced a complete remission. 50 to 80% of patients with other blood cancers, including non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, also saw a reduction in symptoms.
So this is encouraging because these are patients that have failed all conventional therapies, including many times a bone marrow or stem cell transplant. So these patients really do not have any other treatment options that are likely to put them into remission. So getting these very high rates of remission is obviously very exciting for us.
Immune system T cells, which are usually fighting invading viruses and bacteria, can also mount a response to cancer, but they're soon overwhelmed by the disease. The work by Hutchinson researchers enhances this natural cancer-fighting ability. Riddell and colleagues tagged patients' T cells with cancer-specific receptor molecules that recognize and attack malignant cells. In this case, the T cells were targeted at a series of blood cancers caused by a malfunction of B cells, another immune system cell. Once the T cells are modified, Riddell says, they're infused back into the patient where they multiply and continue to fight cancer.
So that's the one interesting thing about this, is it doesn't require repeated treatments or repetitive cycles of chemotherapy. And I think that's what I think in the future may be most important for patients, is that it's a single treatment as opposed to many months of treatment.
Manipulating the immune system has already shown promise against melanoma, a lethal form of skin cancer, and some lung cancers. But currently, immunotherapy is considered a treatment of last resort for other cancer patients. Riddell thinks that may change.
You know, we still have a lot of work to do to establish exactly where the place of immunotherapy will be in cancer therapy, but there's no question now that it is becoming a very useful modality, and in some cases is a replacement for or just superior to chemotherapy.
Riddell and colleagues presented details of their living cancer therapy, as they call it, at the recent annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And just to fill you in just a bit on what's happening on the U.S. political scene, just before a primary election in South Carolina, a spokesman for Pope Francis insists that the pontiff was in no way launching an attack on Donald Trump, the U.S. presidential candidate, nor was he trying to sway voters by declaring someone who advocates building walls isn't Christian. And spokesman for the pontiff stressed that Francis often speaks about building bridges and not walls, and that his remark on Thursday wasn't a personal attack on the business mogul. Flying back to Rome from a trip to Mexico, Francis, answering a reporter's question, said that a person who advocates building walls is not Christian, and Trump has repeatedly called for a wall to divide the U.S. and Mexico. That's our show. Please visit us at our website at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman. Thanks for being with us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Barack Obama recently opened the U.S.-ASEAN summit in Sunnylands, California, stating that few regions present more opportunity to the 21st century than the Asia-Pacific. In order to take advantage of that opportunity, the U.S. has pursued a policy of engagement with Southeast Asia and ASEAN, which is central to the region's peace and prosperity. Together, said President Obama, ASEAN members can continue to increase the trade and economic partnership that create jobs and opportunity for people throughout the region. Over the last 7 years, trade between the United States and ASEAN has increased by 55%. The region is now our fourth largest goods trading partner, said President Obama. U.S. companies have been the largest source of foreign investment in ASEAN, one of the many reasons the region's gross domestic product has surged in recent years, lifting people from poverty to the middle class. President Obama urged ASEAN members to do more to encourage entrepreneurship and innovation so that growth and development is sustainable and benefits all people. ASEAN also has an important security role to play. In recent years, the U.S. has increased its maritime security assistance to its allies and partners in the region, improving mutual capabilities to protect lawful commerce and to respond to humanitarian crises. President Obama urged ASEAN states to advance a shared vision of regional order, where international rules and norms, including freedom of navigation, are upheld, and where disputes are resolved through peaceful, legal means. Political freedom and accountability continue to play an important role in the region. The election in Burma and the political transition underway there give hope for a nation that is peaceful, united, and democratic. In joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Singapore, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Brunei have committed to high labor and environmental standards. As President Obama noted, strong, prosperous, and inclusive societies require good governance, rule of law, accountable institutions, vibrant civil societies, and upholding human rights. The vision that brings ASEAN nations together, said President Obama, is economic growth, creating opportunity for all, mutual security and the peaceful resolution of disputes, and human dignity, including respect for human rights and development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.